So the focus of this particular chapter, which is entitled Conviction, Warmth, Color, and Imagination. It's on love, both human and divine, and on the role of emotion in effective prayer, and I'm mostly going to talk about that, and what happens when you listen to that creative urge in your life. So I really wanted to focus on both the emotion in effective prayer and also dealing with your creative urge. And John is going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about Sir Edward Elgar, who was 161 yesterday.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow.
I was going to have him over for dinner, but...
But the graveyard wouldn't dig him up.
That's right. But he was one of the most prominent composers in England of recent memory, which is why he's really important. Why did John and I talk about music so much? Well, because it's analogous to the spiritual process. There are so many things that we learn through either performance or some other aspect of music. It's not all performance. Some of it's composing, some of it's decomposing. And then you have all the backup people that need to be involved that have to know a little bit about music. Maybe they're doing sound or they're doing the booking or things like that. But there's always this infrastructure. So music isn't just somebody sitting on stage. It's a lot more. But all of what I'm talking about does pertain. So Holmes says that I believe the divine patterns are eternally being made. When you design a new dress, I don't know how many he designed, but anyhow, you don't think that the dress has ever been made before, do you? Every day a new song is sung. I think that God composes all music, sings all songs, but he's singing them in every singer right now, and he doesn't have to repeat himself because there's no monotony in the divine life. Now, so he's talking about music, he's talking about making a dress, but it could be anything. It could be Stephen sitting there drawing or writing. It could be making dinner. It could be driving in to work. There's, you know, it applies to everything. There's no place where God is not. So I decided what I would do is I would turn to my dear friend Neville Goddard. He's got a lot of wonderful books out there, and the one I looked at in particular for this talk is called Feeling is the Secret. He has a lot of books that are available for very little money, if none at all, on Kindle, and I highly recommend downloading them if you can, or maybe Google Books or something like that. But what I like about the way Neville writes is there's something in it, it's very practical. He says a lot of the same thing over and over again, just like when I talk in these meetings, I'm kind of saying the same thing over and over again. It's just a lot of times I'm getting a new insight, and so I'll touch on that. So he says, and pertaining to feeling and life, is that feeling is the one and only medium through which ideas are conveyed to the subconscious. And the subconscious mind impresses the subconscious. The conscious mind impresses the subconscious, while the role of the subconscious mind is to express all that's impressed on it. And that really hit me this time. I thought, could you hold up the teaching symbol? The little banner?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so we have the two lines, we have the V, and what we call the descent into matter, but it's basically thought precedes action, precedes manifestation. And I mean, that the teaching symbol illustrates it perfectly. For those that can't see it, you may want to look up any religious science website, and there should be a...
It's over there as well.
It's also on the banner that we have in our meeting. So he says that the subconscious mind accepts everything that's sent to it, which is a scary thought. And And it gives us total control over our creations, which is both a good thing and a bad thing. And that feeling is the one and only medium through which ideas are conveyed to the subconscious. So, as we often say here, what we think and we believe are extremely important. And the older I get, the more I live this philosophy, the more I realize how true that is and how important it is to be mindful of what it is I'm trying to put into my subconscious mind. So basically, every time you make an impression on your subconscious, it will be expressed unless you send a more powerful thought after that, which will cancel the first thought. So whichever thought is dominant will win. And so I was, you know, immediately what came to mind was thinking about being in a restaurant and ordering a burger with fries. And then I get this feeling like, oh, I should be eating something a little more healthy, so I'm going to order a veggie burger. So I got to get the waiter to go into the kitchen and cancel that initial order for the beef burger and get me a veggie burger and also a gluten-free bun and sweet potato fries. But the problem is I may be waiting a little late, and my initial order might be almost done and ready to be brought out. But I mean, that's kind of how the subconscious works is, yeah, you can put in your order and then you may change your mind a little bit. And depending on how much emphasis, like I could say to the waiter, I absolutely refuse to eat your beef burgers. I'm sorry I ordered it. I'll never come back here unless you bring me a veggie burger.
Funny.
So to put your order into the subconscious, you need to put yourself into the feeling place of having what it is that you want. So, you know, if I were in the restaurant, I'd be thinking about feeling healthy and making it easy to eat the things that bring me good health. And so if I dwell on barriers or difficulties, that sort of thing, I might be, for instance, married to somebody that loves to eat meat all the time, and you know, and that could be a barrier for me. Or some kind of delay will produce the results you do not want. And I know that, at least for myself, I've occasionally done that in my life. So to sum it up in Neville's words, you're already that which you want to be, and your refusal to believe this is the only reason you don't see it. So to get... this is the best part of all. To get what you want, you got to go to sleep. Now, you know, that sounds really crazy, but what you need to do before you go to sleep is start envisioning what it is you want to be, do, or have. Just envision that, and you know, until you feel like you're there, and then go to sleep. And while you're asleep, the subconscious mind is really busy. It's, you know, very active. And it will go to work on that. It's like the chef, and it's going to bring out the order eventually. And make sure when you're doing this that you have that sense that your desire is fulfilled. We do the same thing in our religious science treatments. We keep going with, you know, what it is we want until we feel it. And then we can say, thanks so much, and it is so. So when Holmes talks about prayer, he says that we need to feel the reality. And he says, our mental acceptances should be filled with conviction, warmth, color, and imagination. Kind of like the title of this chapter. Mm-hmm. And the creative power responds to feeling more quickly than any other mental attitude. And therefore, we should try to feel the reality of what we are doing when we give a treatment. And the reality is we become more and more convinced that spirit responds to us. So he's basically saying the same thing that Neville Goddard said, only in slightly different words. He didn't talk about going to sleep, but he talked about, you know, the creative power responds more quickly to feeling than anything else. So I started thinking about the music analogy again, and in the arts, technique is considered very important. I don't know about you, John, but I've spent, when I was a serious student, we'd normally practice about 5 hours a day. Wow. Our first hour would be spent doing scales. and then maybe an hour or two doing what we call etudes or exercises. And why do we do that? It's because it helps us build the physical memory of what it feels like to play, and it builds up strength in the arms or whatever, mouth, depending on what you're playing. And it helps you build your technique. And you need to be able to have that technique either as an artist or as a performer to faithfully perform the music of the composer. But no amount of technique will make a performance interesting if there's no feeling behind it, if it's just very flat. So feeling is important in a lot of things. And we could probably go on and on talking about different aspects of our life where feeling is so important. Otherwise, it's just like eating oatmeal without anything on it. It's kind of boring. So we're going to get back to Sir Edward Elgar. He was not born a sir. He was born in Worcestershire. Is that? I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. But
forgive me, I think it's Worcester. Worcester? Is that anybody's...
He died in Worcester. He died in
Worcestershire.
Worcestershire, like the sauce.
Yeah. That's not pronounced Worcester?
With the shear at the end, it's pronounced Worcestershire, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Without the shear at the end, it's pronounced Worcester, at least in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Got it?
Right.
I was thinking of the Brits. Excuse me.
Yes. So, why is Sir Edward Elgar important? And I didn't know this, and I'm just amazed. We had in the Baroque era, we had Henry Purcell, who was, was probably one of the best known composers of that time ever. And the Brits weren't well known for their inspired compositions. So there was kind of a level period if there were composers that weren't real well known. And then you have Sir Edward Elgar. He stopped his formal schooling at age 15, and he worked in a lawyer's office. But his dad was an organist and a music dealer, and his mother was really well educated, self-taught probably, and so she gave him that love of knowledge and learning. So what his dream was to go to Leipzig and study, but unfortunately his parents didn't have that kind of money. So he stayed home. He was an excellent violinist, and he also played the bassoon. And he spent periods of time as a bandmaster and a church organist, and he was working in the law office. How many musicians do you know that do that? Mm-hmm. You know, they take what we call a straight gig,
a day job,
to pay the rent, right? And so he continued. But what was interesting, and this is so related to feeling and desire, is that along the way, and I was really blessed, somebody, John sent me a doctoral dissertation on Elgar's life. The guy studied. There were things in his life that taught him composition, and so he grew as a musician and as a composer, and eventually he became a professor at the University of Birmingham, and he was their first music professor, and he was married to a lovely lady named Alice. They found out that she was marrying a musician, and they disinherited her, because we all know that musicians are they can't provide. And frankly, I think she was a slave for him. She'd do things like, in music we have what we call the staff, the five lines, mm-hmm. that you need to have to compose on. Well, back then they didn't have Xerox machines. They didn't have, they weren't printing out sheets of paper so that you could write your compositions. So she'd do that for him. She'd walk out in the rain with, newly composed pieces to deliver to some publisher, just to, make sure that he was able to keep going. So she was his muse in many ways. And not only that, she was also providing a lot of the practical support that he needed. So, anyhow, she unfortunately died in 1920, and he stopped writing because he didn't have that inspiration anymore. But he was good friends with a man named George Bernard Shaw. Like I said, he's well educated. And fortunately, Shaw got him to get back into composing again, and he began to write. So he did quite a bit. And he was the greatest English composer since Henry Purcell. Purcell died in 1695. Right, yeah, it's almost 200 years of this black hole in English music. So he based a lot of what he did both on English tradition and on the European tradition. So what I'm trying to say in all of this is that, A, he had a really strong desire. The life arranged himself so he was able to study. His life became his schooling. He was able to travel. I believe he made it to Leipzig, but he certainly got to the continent. And, I mean, he was just amazing. So what he had was this creative urge that was there apparently from childhood, and he just followed that. And I know somebody else has done that too. Do you?
I've known a few.
Yeah? Do you want to talk about it, John?
Thank you so much. The creative urge is something that, in my experience, doesn't want to be stifled, doesn't want to be tempered. And to associate myself with your comments, too, about education, I remember a time for about 10 or 12 years where I practiced maybe 3 to 5 hours every day and hardly ever missed for any reason. And it was something that chose me. I believe that music or other art forms choose us. We don't necessarily choose to do those things. And that creative urge wants to be satisfied. And why music? Well, for me, it is the rhythm. It's the essence of vibration that draws me to it. So, for example, we are all on different kinds of rhythms that may not be audible. But we have meal times. We have sleeping and waking. We have working and recreating. And if you speed up those vibrations, eventually it's going to come into an audible range of vibrations. So a sound is going to come up, a way of feeling the vibrations in the body. If I slow this vibration down, it might become a vibration that is not so audible. Maybe the vibrations of the planets as Robert Flood in the Middle Ages, or in Renaissance times, he came up with this idea of the music of the spheres. Well, we have that going on all around us. And so to be creative with that, to me, is a very natural idea. And regarding vibrations, now it's even with science too. I have a friend, he's actually in one of my yoga classes. He is a geophysicist. And the figure they use, the period for planet Earth that they use is 7 cycles or periods per minute, and that is the waves hitting the beaches of the world. It's about 7 times per minute that waves are hitting. So they use that period as the vibration for planet Earth. So if you take that 7 per minute and you multiply it by 60, you'll get 7 per second. Now that happens to be about the slowest vibration that the human ear can hear as a musical pitch, about 7. So when you go to the far left of the piano, that very lowest key, that's way down there. You can almost not hear it as a musical frequency, but it's there. It's hitting on the eardrums. And so that's a very precious idea, to be able to connect our artistic music with the intuitive realm, when vibrations are so slow we can't hear them anymore. We can feel them, though. Mm-hmm. And so all of these vibrations are important, and for me it manifests in the art of music. But it's not the only art. How am I doing?
We're doing good. Can you talk a little bit about... you have a busy life already, and somehow, something has kept you going in the field of music, which you tie together with meditation and yoga, and you managed to, from my perception. You make music work in your life. Somehow, you know, kids are fed, you know, and that sort of thing. Everybody's wearing clothes and all of that. But somehow it works for your life.
Yes.
Is there some kind of urge behind that, you know, to continue performing? Because you could have gone to law school.
This is true. I could have done a lot of different things. Everyone in this room could probably have done a lot of things. Why did we choose what we were doing? Well, for me, music very early was a kind of a safety valve. You know, I remember when I was, many years ago, I went to a party with the gymnastics team at Queens College. I graduated too early from high school. But at this party, a gentleman was playing, one of the guys on the team, on the gym team, was playing the flamenco guitar. And I was drawn to that. My goodness, my mother's family is from Texas and from Mexico. And that resonated with me. I said, I have to learn about this. And then I was driven. The bug bit me. It was a Saturday night. Stores would be closed the next day. So I looked up in the family encyclopedia, guitar. And I found the tuning, E-A-D-G-B-E, ascending. And those buttons are all in a row on the accordion, by the way. On the left hand of the accordion, there's a logos, a logic in there. Well, the bug bit me. And so on the first Monday, that Monday, I took $30 and I got a used guitar from a pawn shop, a classical guitar. I bought a couple of books, and that was the start. But it wasn't really a beginning yet. I played for a few years on my own. I took some basic training at Juilliard, and I went there twice a week and spent the whole 2 days there asking questions about all of the instruments. I was driven, and I've been that way with most of my interests over the years. When I am interested in something, I plunge right in. I learn everything I can, do my homework. If there's a reason why I can do a lot of things, it's only because I'm hard driving. I don't like the word talent so much. I don't use it with my students because I believe that sometimes it's a crutch behind people saying, oh, I didn't have talent. You know, I didn't become an astronaut because I didn't have talent, or I didn't become a screen star. No, do it now. That's what I'm doing. I'm becoming interested in the cello. I'll be renting one for a start. What drives me there? It's the prospect of a new adventure, a new way of making sound, a new way of appreciating music. I may or may not become very advanced on the instrument, but that's not the point. The point will be to satisfy this urge, this creative drive that's bigger than I am. And I'll see where it takes me. Because if I don't satisfy it, I'll be doing myself harm if I don't satisfy this urge.
Right.
So it's going to be a cycle. Then these cycles are back and forth. If I hear this bowl, this metal is going back and forth, just like the earth around the sun. It goes back and forth, 365 days to go the full cycle. But it's happening, whether I want it to or not, whether I believe it's happening or not. And this creative urge with me is going to cycle too. So the new urge that we all have should be adhered to. You should, in my opinion only, I can't say which people should do. That's not quite the word. But my recommendation is to take this next creative thing that you want to do and follow through with it in some way. It could be that you want the discipline of reading music, or the discipline of mastering certain basics, or it might be just that you want to use your hands. So the question is, do you like to move your hands? Do you think you'd like to fulfill a cycle for yourself about moving your hands? And how will that feel good to you? Making it feel good. And so to make myself feel good, I follow through with my creativity. One of the things I like to do is calligraphy. And I have rendered in calligraphy a quotation from Edward Elgar, Sir Edward Elgar. And each of you will have this diploma.
Awesome.
With the quotation from Edward Elgar.
Thank you.
This is a good time to distribute it?
Well, let me finish up, and we'll take a break.
Okay.
So, what you got to hear from John is that there's something inside of us that's unstoppable. And see, if you talk about things like that, you have that feeling already of gotta do, you know, just gotta have just that impulse. And in a way, that's kind of what you have to be to get the subconscious working. I have no doubt that he's going to attract a wonderful cello, and that he's going to totally enjoy it, or he's going to move on and do something else. But I think that it's so important, as we understand our ability to create and our role in working with our subconscious, to feed it the stuff that feels good, the stuff that makes, you know, it's kind of like going without rain for a while. We have a drought. Well, let's feed our subconscious. Let's feed it with things that feel really good. And so it gets easier to that point when you're about to fall asleep at night and I'm thinking, I want a full-size cello. I want it. I want a German luthier. I want, I get myself into that place, but it's a lot easier because I'm already in a place where I'm feeling really good. And I'm giving into that creative urge I have inside. So that ties back music, creativity, and prayer. So I wanted to close with an affirmation from Holmes that comes at the end of the chapter. I now accept all that I have hoped for and believed in. There is nothing in me that can doubt that good will make its appearance in my experience. There is nothing in me that can dissipate my faith or dim its clear realization. I see in everyone that which I know to be true about myself. Therefore, everyone I think of is blessed by my thought. And so it is.
And so it is.
So it is.
Well, thank you, Jess.